Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with one of my all-time heroes, and I'm not kidding about that, musicologist, photographer, filmmaker, and founding member of the New Lost City Ramblers, John Cone. John will be performing with the Downhill Strugglers Friday, September 7th at 5 p.m. and doing an afternoon storytelling workshop Saturday, September 8th at 2 p.m. as part of the Old Tone Roots Music Festival at Cool Whisper Farm in North Hillsdale, New York. You can find out more at www.oldtonemusicfestival. That's one word, oldtonemusicfestival.com. We'll talk with John Cone about his life, his music, and his coming performance. But first, welcome, John Cone. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have you here.
Well, I'm glad you're still alive. And me too.
Right side of the dirt, as they say. Okay, so John Cone, I have to tell you one story to begin with. As you probably don't know, you were a great hero to many of us who were just a little bit younger than you. Not that much, but just a little bit younger than you. And you had, as I remember it, a corduroy jacket that you would play in. And we would go to see the New Lost City Ramblers, my friends and I, and everybody noticed your corduroy jacket. So we all bought corduroy jackets.
Oh, my God.
And somebody said, what's that jacket? We all say, it's our John Cone jacket. So you were truly an icon among the West Side guys that I knew and the people at Camp Bronx House and Bucks Rock Work Camp. We all had our John Cone jackets.
Well, let me give you a little quick interpretation. I never heard that story about my jacket, but the first time the New Lost City Ramblers were photographed, and was by the great photographer Robert Frank, who was my neighbor. Well, we wanted to kind of evoke the old records with music we learned from. So those guys didn't dress up in blue jeans and work shirts. The old musicians dressed up in jackets and ties.
Sure.
But at that moment, between Tom Paley, Mike Seeger, and myself, I was the only one who had a jacket and a tie.
Oh, now that's funny.
So for the photograph, Tom Paley was wearing Izzy Young's jacket, and
Mike Seeger
was wearing one of my jackets.
That's very funny. Well, let's go where this is directing us, because you've accomplished so much. I mean, you are regarded as one of the premier photographers in the United States, and your photographs are in museums all over the country. But there is, of course, my thing, which is the New Lost City Ramblers. We all knew them, by the way, every tune, backwards and forwards. We weren't good at it, as good as you are, of course, but we all knew that Roosevelt called for volunteers, you know, and the rest of it. So the question is, how did the New Lost City Ramblers get started?
Well, before the Ramblers, Tom Paley and myself used to run hoots, kind of informal folk music things, at Yale, at the art school, where I was a student and he was a mathematician. And then after that, he was teaching in Maryland and going to parties. And I went down to visit him one time to copy some old records he had, the old 78s. And then someone invited us to be on the first FM radio show. And then Mike Seeger called and said, I was invited to that show too. Can I join you? So we met on the way to the radio station and played, you know, in the car or maybe just in the rehearsal room, and then went right on the air. And it fit together so interestingly. I was so excited about the sound that we got because Mike was a fiddler and he knew a lot of the same songs. And so I went to New York and I said to Mo Ash, who was Folkways Records, I said, I just heard I'm playing with a group of guys and it has the excitement that old Woody Guthrie and Sonny Terry and Cisco Houston Records made for you. He says, oh, yeah, who was in the band? I said, well, Mike Seeger and Tom Paley. Okay, you can make a record.
So Mike Seeger, of course, was royalty. Did he not like being referenced with Pete?
Well, yeah, it was attention then, but it wasn't spoken. He was striking out on his own.
Sure.
But he wasn't known at that point. He was working on two very, very interesting projects at the same time we started the Ramblers. He had just done American Banjo, Scrugg style.
Yep.
Then he did Mountain Music Bluegrass style. And that was the first time the word bluegrass was applied to the music, not to Bill Monroe's band. This was a major shift in thinking. And this was happening at the same time we were forming the New Lost City Ramblers. It's very interesting historically.
How'd you learn all those words? It's incredible.
Which words?
The words to all the songs. I mean, that was great music, but some of them were kind of complicated.
And some of them weren't that accurate, but we did the best we could. Well, we learned a whole scratchy record. In the years since then, everybody's found, you know, really mint copies and learned how to understand the words. But it's such a rich field. To me, it's amazing that here we are 50 or 60 years later, and there's more and more wonderful material coming into view. It's never closed off. It keeps opening up, and I'm amazed. And it was interesting because in those days, the folk music world didn't know what the heck we were talking about.
Absolutely. Except that, I can tell you this, for point of reference, I'm now 77 years old, and we used to look for concerts to go to. Well, of course, if Pete were playing, you always went to Pete, or before that, the Weavers. But second on our list was the New Lost City Ramblers. I mean, if they were there, we were going to go, and we were going to listen to you guys. And the music was just wonderful. It was so great. So who picked the songs, and how did you get them?
We picked them off of old records and old songs that we knew about. But once we started, once the first record, you know, the first band and our repertoire fell together, then there was, you know, tremendous interest across the country. Not waves of interest, but people interested in what we were doing. So it stimulated us to do more. And then record collectors, not folklorists, but record collectors, would come to us and say, hey, you're performing the kind of music that we collect. So they'd give us access to their huge collections of old 78s. And it was wonderful. So we heard so much that way.
But somebody had to listen to them, right, John, and say, okay, I'm going to do all of the music. I'm going to write it all down, and I'm going to teach it to the others.
Well, it was endless, but I can give you one memory. There was a wonderful guy named Eugene Earle, who was an aeronautical engineer, but he spent most of his money collecting old records. I'd never heard of him. He wasn't in folk music, but he came up to me at a concert once and said, you guys are playing the kind of music that I collect. Why don't you come out to my place and you can tape any of the records I have? So I had this kind of a clunky tape recorder, and I strapped it to the back of my, wasn't a motorcycle, it was a little scooter.
Yeah, Vespa or something, yeah.
And I drove up the West Side Highway, which in those days was cobblestones, and across the George Washington Bridge with this thing on my back of my thing. I get to his house, and there's 10,000 records on the walls. He says, I'll tape anything you want. Which one do you want to hear? And I didn't know where to begin. So from zero to this incredible riches was really something. And then he'd give me lists of all the things that he owned. And I just have to do my intuitive best to see if some title or some word or something in a song caught my attention. And then we'd play that one, and then I'd tape it, and then we'd follow up on it. I think the greatest discovery I made, I'll never forget it, it was a record called something like the Conqueror label, and it was a picture of a knight in armor, which had nothing to do with old-time music. And the song was The Sweet Sunny South on one side.
Take me back to the place where I first saw the light. To the sweet sunny south, take me home, where the mockingbird sang me to sleep in the night. Oh, while as I tilted to roam, oh, I think with regrets of the dear friends I left, of the dear hearts that sheltered me there, of my wife and my family, of whom I bereft. For the old place again do I sigh.
And old Joe Clark on the other.
His pay. Never saved a golden eagle, drank it all away.
Farewell, Old Joe Clark, goodbye, Betsy Brown. Farewell, Old Joe Clark, I'm gonna leave this town.
It said Jackson Young was the musician, two banjos and a fiddle. I said, oh my God. And it was the most incredible music. And that's what led to Tommy Jarrell's discovery later on. This was Tommy Jarrell's parents.
Wow. So you grew up in New York City?
I grew up in Queens.
And then later
moved to the suburbs, or I was moved to the suburbs.
What was your first instrument?
I guess it was guitar, but banjo at the same time.
Uh-huh. How did you keep the band together? I mean, one of the things I've often thought of, you had Paley teaching mathematics. I mean, somebody sooner or later had to decide, I'm either going to be a full-time musician or I'm going to do my other work.
Yeah, well, that's what broke the Ramblers apart after a few years.
Yeah.
But Mike and myself became so dedicated to the music, so dedicated. In the first year, or first couple of years, I was a fool, but a lucky fool. I respected those guys so much and their music that I said, okay, they'll do the brilliant music and I'll just arrange things. So I worked with Mo Ash. I did the record covers. I did the notes. I did the booking. I did the coordinating. It was exhausting, but it was exhilarating. And after a few years, Mike took it on as well. And Tom just came along when he would.
So eventually, was it Tom who left first because of the mathematics?
No, after 3 years, there was some nibbles from huge agencies trying to persuade us to go and sign with them, and we did like fools. They promised us all kinds of stuff, and then we were stranded out on the road because they didn't get us any work. So at that point, you know, Tom says, well, I'm leaving. And Mike and myself said, we're continuing.
And so you got a third guy, right?
Oh, yeah, Tracy Schwarz. He joined us. That was way back in 1963. You know, we've been with us for 45 years. He's a great musician, Tracy.
Yep, he certainly was. So how long did the band play all together?
Well, we staggered on for 50 years. That's when Mike died at 50 years. But it was really strong for the first 10, and then maybe the next 10 it was okay, and then it was occasional.
Yeah.
But the effect, the ripple effect was amazing because everywhere we went, another little string band would show up. And then the idea of traditional music, you know, it just kind of took over a whole bunch of festivals and young musicians. It was exciting. And we weren't out to be stars. We never were. But it was a movement. Everywhere you went across the country, there were string bands, and that was so exciting. As a matter of fact, at some point, I was at a party with Freddie Hellerman of the
Weavers. Yeah.
Weavers.
Yeah.
And he was standing, oh, yeah, we sold so many million records, and all the girls and the women were standing around him, and we did this, and we played at the hotel, and we did this, and we did that. And I'm standing off to the side all by myself. No one's paying any attention to me. I wasn't feeling badly. I said, gee, this is strange. I said, there's Freddie. I said, how many bands are playing Weavers music now? None. And how many bands are playing the kind of music I did? Everywhere in the country. So I felt better.
That's really something. Let's move off of that for a moment to your photography. You went to Yale, you studied photography and art. You've become, you know, one of the major photographers in the country. And now, give us a little history about how all of that happened.
Well, I had been a painter, and then I got caught up in photography. And the photography somehow connected with the music. And even with film. And so my degree in painting was really a photographic project in Peru, where I had gone to study weaving and wrote a thesis about weaving. But it's really interesting how those fell together. But then when I came back to New York with those photographs, in those days there was absolutely no galleries that showed photography, but then one opened on Sheridan Square. And somehow they got to me, and I had my first exhibit then. And then I continued doing photography along the way, and it's always been a very serious part of my life. It's not the same as music, although it reveals a lot about the music. I don't know if you've ever seen my photographs from Kentucky. I went to Kentucky in 1959.
Indeed. Yes.
And so I was recording music and documenting it at the same time. It's very interesting because right now, Ken Burns is doing a big series on American country music, and they're using a bunch of my photographs, and most of them are from that 1959 trip.
That's amazing.
They're good photographs. It's so interesting how that life, it never became, you know, popular or famous, but yes, I do have a reputation as a good photographer, and I'm very proud of it.
Well, you know, John Cone, years ago, I saw quite an article, I believe it was in the New York Times, about your photography and what you had accomplished.
Well, there was one by Greil Marcus. He had reviewed a book of mine, my first big book of photographs, called There Is No I. And I think that's what you must have seen. It was a very serious article. It took my work
seriously.
It did.
It was long and it was exciting and I was proud of you. I thought that was great. We're talking with musicologist, photographer, filmmaker, and founding member of the New Lost City Ramblers, John Cohn. John will be performing with the Downhill Strugglers Friday, September 7th, and doing an afternoon storytelling workshop Saturday, September 8th at 2 p.m. in the Old Tone Music Festival at Cool Whisper Farm. Isn't that great? Cool Whisper Farm in North Hillsdale, New York. For more information, head to www.oldtonemusicfestival. That's one word, oldtonemusicfestival.com. And John, how did they get you to do this? How did they get you to perform on and to do this? I know, you know, you're quite a catch.
I guess there's a pun in there somewhere. I'm quite a catch. It suggested it's a fall.
On the contrary, but it's so very good of you to do it. And you're playing with a band. Tell us about how that happened.
The band is called the Downhill Strugglers.
Well, one of these days it won't be long to call for me, but I'll be gone. There old Zama got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't weep. I've got me man, and he made him out of clay. Put him on earth, but not to stay. There old Zama got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you moan.
I met them about 10 years ago, you know, as individuals. At that stage, you could take the three of them and add their ages all together, and I'd be older than all those ages combined. And, of course, they're wonderful musicians, and they carry on. And I don't know how it happened, but they have a very similar attitude about the music that the Ramblers have. Play it well, play it close, play it accurate, don't sell out. Don't try to commercialize it, and don't compromise, and let the music speak and play it as well as you can. And they're really interesting guys. They really are. I've watched them grow. One of them is a fellow named Eli Smith, who's a descendant of the folk music world. He knows about Oscar Brand and all the old things in the Weavers. He knows about the whole political past, but he's arrived at this position that on traditional old-time music. And there's a place in Brooklyn called Jalopy Theater, and it's a huge hangout for people of this belief in music. I swear that maybe a third or maybe half of the performers at Old Tone are all known for circulating around Jalopy. And it's a very exciting time because it's like a new surge of interest in this music, and it's younger people playing it. It's not old folks like me. So I'm very excited. It really gives me a second life when I perform with them.
John Cohn, you mentioned your politics. Were you radical in the 60s? I mean, what happened?
Well, in the 60s, it's interesting because we all could see what was happening in the civil rights movement and the counterculture. But we were also deep in this mission about old-time music. And that was very strong. So that in a strange way, while the 60s and the civil rights movement, which was based on, you know, disturbing the order that existed and confronting the issues between North and South or Southern prejudices, there we were visiting Southern musicians, learning from them, sitting at their feet, recording them, bringing them to New York, doing concerts with them. And we were building bridges. That's where Doc Watson came out of that.
Did you bring Doc Watson up?
Well, it wasn't me personally, but it was this organization that me and Ralph Rinsler and Izzy Young made, the Friends of Old Time Music. He was part of a band that included Clarence Ashley. Clarence Ashley was a great recording artist way back in the 20s. I mean, we're talking about generations and issues. And so we were aware of the politics of the 60s, but we were also on this interesting mission, which was building bridges at the same time.
So did they clash? Did they clash?
It's too complicated to get into. I'd love to talk with you about it. It also became an issue between Tom Paley and Mike Seeger and myself. Tom thought we were being blacklisted because of his past, and that wasn't so, but he chose to think it that way. Tom had a very interesting problem. He loved Southern music, but he couldn't stand going into the South. We once had a concert in North Carolina. He couldn't get out of the car to eat at a restaurant that said Whites Only. And so to me, it was a really interesting challenge that he would feel for this music, but couldn't accept the culture. He couldn't accept looking at it through their point of view. And, of course, Mike and myself had to accommodate both, and we did.
Amazing, amazing. You know, you referenced Oscar Brand earlier. You know, I knew him a little bit back in the day. And, you know, he had the longest radio program in, I believe, in history, anywhere.
Yeah.
On WNYC. Did you guys get on that program?
Sure, early on. When, you know, but we weren't a regular. We just, because we were in and out of New York. But we were on once or twice at least. And I was on several other times. My brother Mike played on his show a lot.
Yeah, and Mike had another cool. Mike had another group. What was that? What was the name of
the Shanty Boys?
The Shanty Boys. Lionel Kilburg, yeah, on the bass. I remember that.
And Roger Sprung is the
Roger
guy
Sprung.
Who brought Scruggs style banjo to New York way back in 48.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Lived on the West Side.
Yeah.
Gave everybody lessons that I knew. Okay. So then the career goes on, and you've done a couple of films. Tell us about your films.
Well, it started off again with that Kentucky trip.
Yep.
I had made recordings and made photographs and issued them on Folkways. And then I brought Roscoe Holcomb, who was a great, great musician. Did some festivals, and so people could hear the music and could see him, and I still didn't feel it conveyed what I was feeling. Even with my photographs, it didn't feel right. And then I got my first little Volkswagen, and I drove through the country
How much did you pay for the Volkswagen?
How much did I pay? $1,800.
I paid $1,600, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, my God, this is crazy. I don't know if anybody's going to understand what we're talking about, but I'm enjoying it immensely.
but that little white Volkswagen of mine, which I bought over from the Pruskys over on the east side of Manhattan, I used that car for 10 years, and I courted my wife in it, and I love that little old white Volkswagen. It was terrific.
Well, my little Volkswagen allowed me to travel through the hills, Kentucky, and hear the music and see the sights. And I said, how can I bring these things together?
Right.
And I said, I'll make a film. A film can have the music and the image at the same time.
How do you know how to do that, John Cone?
How to drive or to
no.
make...
No, how to make the film.
Well, I was already a still photographer.
Right.
And actually, it was in 1959, Robert Frank made his first film. It was called Pull My Daisy. It was about the Beat Generation with Kerouac and Ginsberg.
Yep.
And he asked me to photograph the production. So I kind of saw how he did it, and I got the idea sort of that way. It wasn't standard filmmaking, but it kind of put the visual, the framing of the picture, put that first. You never lost sight of that. And so that kind of shaped my first film, which is, in retrospect, a very good film. It's called The High Lonesome Sound. So I made that, and then I made a second film about ballad singing, and then another film about where I live, and then I started traveling. I did run across a whole United States called Musical Holdouts, included Ralph Stanley quite early, and a lot of very great stuff. And then I started filming in Peru.
Farther back and higher up into the Andes, one gets closer to the aboriginal source of this music. Panpipes require a unique cooperation between the musicians. Each set of panpipes can only play half the notes of the scale.
So I made six films in Peru.
No kidding.
And I got grants. I've done 17 films over my life now.
How did you finance all of that? Was it hard to get the money to do those films?
What money? You know, it was very hard. there was no national endowments at all when I started. So I was borrowing money and making these films really cheap. Cheaply, pardon me, not cheap. And it shows, but the people accept that. People know in film. They know the size of your budget just from the production values, and they can see past it. And then eventually, well, actually, my first Peru film, Pete Seeger gave me some money. My father gave me some money. The Friends of Old Time Music let me use a tape recorder, and used relatives and scrapped it together. It's never been a big financial success, but that was never the point. If I wanted it to be a financial success, I wouldn't have made those films.
You mentioned Pete giving you some money. How did that go? I mean, if he was your brother-in-law, how did you approach him, and or did he just offer?
I told him I was trying to make this film and I was getting nowhere. And his other son-in-law, Emilio, wanted to join me. So here's a chance for him to kind of help support two family members, get their artwork done. And that film that we did, it ended up on Nova. I just showed it recently. It's a very good film.
I was going to ask you, John Cohn, if somebody in love with your work wanted to see some of these films, how could they do it? Is there a place to go?
It's pretty difficult. The Kentucky films are available on Shonicky Home Video. Shonicky is a very good record company and has a lot of good videos. The Peru work was all published in a gigantic book that a German publisher called Steidl did. Steidl. It's called Past, Present, Peru. It's four volumes in one package. One is like 200 pages of my photographs. Another is 100 pages of my work with textiles. And then another has six of my films. And another has the music I recorded in Peru. But you could find that on Amazon, perhaps. And it's not cheap, but it's not ridiculously expensive. The problem with my other films is that the institutional. The guy sells to libraries and universities. And, you know, you could get all of my films if you ask your public library to get them. But to buy them directly from the distributor is too costly. And I just can't put them up online, although I think there's something called Folkstreams that carries some of them. You can just see them online.
John Cohn, tell me about the film Appalachia. You know, your high lonesome sound becomes synonymous with all of that. But what were they like? What were these people like? Did you have to talk them into doing this stuff? You went around and you got them to appear.
You know, in a way, when we talk about them, it sounds like they're strange. But actually, the strange one was me. I was in their midst. You know, here's this guy, young guy with a camera. And I was never mistaken for a media person. You know, I was so clumsy I had so little production values. No lights, no big stuff. Actually, the first film I made about Roscoe Holcomb, after the first few weeks, he says, I don't feel like filming anymore. I said, oh, my God. I came all the way down here, have all this stuff together, and he doesn't want to do it. But, you know, there's a kid up the road. They say he's as good as Bill Monroe. Let's go visit him. We visit him, and his family says, oh, yeah. And they played some music. Well, we got church practice. Why don't you come to the church with us? So then I sang at the church, and then I filmed at the church. And just one thing led to another. It was never like I'm making a movie for PBS or, you know, will you sign a contract? It was never that kind of a thing at all. And if somebody didn't want to be in the film, they just got out of my way.
So you gave all your stuff to the Library of Congress in 2011, and we're talking about all your films, photographs, music recordings, and all the other stuff. What did they do with it? I mean, if somebody wanted to go to the Library of Congress, could you see all the John Cohn stuff?
Yes, it's all there. You can look at it, and I think if you want to publish it or do something with it, you'd have to get my permission. But I'm so blessed that all my work is there. It frees me to do new work.
That's right. Have you spent much? I know that Pete sent all his stuff to the Smithsonian, I think.
But all of Pete's films are there at the Library of Congress as well.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
As a matter of fact, when I went there, a wonderful curator said, John, I want you to see this. And he led down the basement, under the basement of the basement of the Library of Congress. And there's some shelves. He says, there's the Alan Lomax collection of films.
Oh, boy.
And here's the Pete Seeger collection of films. And that space there is for the John Cohn collection of films. I said, I don't belong here. He says, that's why we want you. He was right. I had something different to offer.
Oh, that's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Well, you said you were enjoying this, and so am I. So I guess the next question is, what about the smell of the Library of Congress? You know, I was a congressional intern for years, and I would go over to the Library of Congress, and I would sit there. And it had a unique smell, which was, I think, you're going to think I'm nuts, but was, I think, from the wax that they used all over the place. Do you ever notice that?
I remember it used to be musty, and it still has some of that must. But they've gotten brighter lights. Yeah. So it's a much more cheery experience. All the old musty hallways with all those ancient decorations, they're now lit like the beautiful art. Whereas before they were kind of, you know, like smelly old stuff. No, the library is very alive. It's very alive now. And I'm not sure if you ever heard of a fellow named Archie Green. Archie was a longshoreman and a wobbly on the West Coast, but he also was very interested in music and folk music and union organizing. And he went later in life, became an academic. And then he went to Washington, D.C., and he lobbied. He lobbied the U.S. Congress to establish the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
Boy.
Amazing. A guy who, you know, was a friend of old-time music, went through all steps and did a successful job. So that's why there's a wonderful, full-blown archive of American folk music at the Library of Congress, open to anybody who wants to go there. Some guy is doing research on a friend of mine, and, oh, my God, I was amazed. He said he went and to the library and was reading my correspondence. Oh, my God. Because I didn't mean that to be public. I thought, you know, years from now he'd read it. But now he's reading it for a book. I don't know what to make of the past, but it's behind me.
We're talking with musicologist, photographer, filmmaker, and founding member of the New Lost City Ramblers, John Cohn. John will be performing with the Downhill Strugglers Friday, September 7th, and doing an afternoon storytelling workshop Saturday, September 8th at 2 p.m. in the Old Tone Roots Music Festival at Cool Whisper Farm in North Hillsdale, New York. For more information, head to oldtonemusicfestival.com. So, John, you had favorite songs when you were with the Ramblers. What were some of your favorite songs?
It wouldn't be so much favorite songs. It would be the challenge of trying to stand up in front of people and do the Talking Hard Luck, which is 3 minutes of just monologue, playing the guitar at the same time. The challenge of standing up and doing that was a great challenge. And, of course, the song that I'm most associated with is the Cuckoo Bird on the banjo and singing it. And I've been doing that since 1960 or so.
Gonna build me a log cabin on the mountain, so high, so I can see Willie as he goes riding by. Jack of Diamonds, Jack of Diamonds, I know you from old. You robbed my poor pocket of my silver and gold. All the cuckoo is a pretty bird. Don't I wish that she was mine? She'd never drink water. She'd only drink wine.
So I can do it backwards and forwards. And recently I've played it upstate Massachusetts. There's something called the Harry Smith Frolic. And it's an amazing thing. Midnight, they all get out together, and everybody does one song or another off the Folkways Anthology. And they asked me to kick off the evening with the Cuckoo Bird. And I just did it. And it just kind of flew out of me. It was wonderful. But the point isn't a single song. The point is really, well, you get the three guys going, the fiddle and banjo and guitar, and the runs and the interaction. It's such fun, and it's indescribable, and sometimes it's really energizing. And now, we did a whole variety of things. Some of the bands that followed us specialized in one sound, and in a way, they were better than us always, because we were always very wide in our approach. But that's just the nature of what we did. That's a roundabout answer, non-answer to your question. Although I must say, that song, The Battleship of Maine.
Oh, yeah.
McKinley called for volunteers, then I got my gun. First Spaniard I saw coming, I dropped my gun and run. It was all about that battleship of Maine. At war with that great nation, Spain. When I get back to Spain, I'm gonna honor my name. It was all about that battleship of Maine. Why are you running? Are you afraid to die? The reason I'm running is because I cannot fly. It was all about that battleship of Maine. The blood was running, I was running too. I give my feet good exercise, I had nothing else to do. It was all about that battleship of Maine.
And Tom sang it originally, but then he left the band. And then came the Vietnam War, and we sang that song throughout the Vietnam War.
I bet you did.
Over and over again, making obtuse references to, you know, guys who didn't want to fight. What are we fighting for? And we use old-time music, and we use references to the Spanish-American War to make our critique heard of the Vietnam War. So it wasn't just simple old-time music. We always had agendas going. And some were social, some were stylistic, some were aesthetic. It was and still is a very interesting life.
You and I are getting a little older. The question I have is, when somebody goes like Mike Seeger or Pete, you know, that's a part of our history. That's part of who we are. How does that affect you? I mean...
Affect me?
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, no, no. You're giving maybe not more credit, but undue credit to the Seeger dynasty. And in a strange way, you and my generations were raised under the wonderful mythology of what folklore was as described by the Seegers and the Lomaxes.
I was going to ask you about the Lomaxes, but go ahead.
And that set a certain tone as to what folk music is supposed to be. But since then, we've had a blast that apart. It's a wonderful part of the past. It's a wonderful outlook, and it's endlessly rewarding. But there's many other ways of looking at the same thing. I mean, consider that the Lomaxes and the Seegers didn't accept old commercial records as valid because they were commercial. That was part of the old left-wing thinking. You know, if it's commercial, that's capitalism, and folk music isn't that. When you think of this, when I went to Kentucky in all my filmmaking, I have never met anybody who I'm filming who uses the word folk. And I've done this extreme difficult challenge for myself, made 17 films about this music, and never used the word folk, because the word folk is an abstraction, and you and I were raised under that abstraction. But we also had to get away from it. Bluegrass music doesn't use folk. Old-time music is a way of getting around folk, and it's very interesting. Oscar never could give it up. Oscar was a barefoot folk singer or something.
Yeah. And he got into trouble, of course, with the Seeger people because, you know, they always accused him of having sold them out during the McCarthy hearings and the rest of it.
Oh, yeah, and that reverberates and reverberates and reverberates. We had to deal with the blacklist, even with what we did. It was extraordinary. There was a wonderful bluegrass fiddler who Mike was recording, and he used to play at Hillbilly Ranch in Boston. And then he was working for Bell Labs, a high-security job in New York. And we made a recording of him to put on one of the records. And then got worried. Could his security clearance be jeopardized by recording for Folkways? Because the blacklist was so damning and controlling. So I went to the head of a very well-known entertainment conglomerate. A friend of mine was kind of one of the executives there. And what he did was he proposed doing a television show with several artists. Gene Ritchie was one of them, Andrew Owen Summers, people who had made records for Folkways. And he sent that to Red Channels, the people who decided whether you were red or not, to see if he could make that program. And they didn't stop him. So it meant if you recorded for Folkways, it wasn't enough to get you blacklisted. So having established that, then we could record the fiddler without jeopardizing. That's the kind of stuff we used to do.
That's a terrific story. What about the Lomaxes? Did you ever meet any of them?
Woo-hoo! Yes, of course. Yeah. Alan and me were contentious all the way through.
Contentious meaning you didn't like each other?
I challenged him, I think. Whereas Mike Seeger and Ralph Rinzer were much more accommodating, my existence challenged his. It was unfortunate because he was such a big influence on me. I don't want to get too deeply into it.
Okay. The work that you have done, of course, is so remarkable. And nothing but great respect for all of your output. But, you know, why don't you write the book? You know, the book, The Life of John Cone.
People ask me to do that, and I realize I'm doing a little piece at a time. People interview me here and this section here and a quote there. And then I've got these 7 or 8 books of my photographs that I've written about. And it's more fun kind of doing like what we're doing, just telling stories rather than writing them down. Or when I go to write them down, it kind of cramps my style or something. I could do it, but I don't think I'm going to get around to it. But I'll say this.
Sure.
Yeah, this is something I'd like to share with you and your listeners. I've used my pursuit and inquiry into this music in a very, it's like it's part of my artwork. It's not like I'm a scientist or a scholar. So when I first went to Peru and I ended up looking at the weaving of the people, I had something in mind. That became a whole field, and it's very respected. My early work has been published. It was just part of something else that I was doing. So I've had the weaving experience. I've had the Peruvian music experience, which has led to some very specific ethnographic. I'm sometimes called an ethnomusicologist because I get off to these corners. But then I make a film about the Appalachian music. Then I made a film about unaccompanied ballad singers in North Carolina. And then I did another film about unaccompanied ballad singers in Britain. And it's just, I'm just moving through all these things that are interesting to me, and they become record projects and photography and film projects on the way. And there's whole fields that are not based on my work, but that include my work. And I'm welcome in so many different places, anthropology, archaeology, ethnomusicology, folklore, filmmaking, photography. And I taught drawing also. I was a professor at SUNY Purchase in the art world there for many years. So it's been a very, very rich life, and it keeps unfolding and never cashes in. But it's a form of living.
We've been talking with musicologist, photographer, filmmaker, and founding member of the New Lost City Ramblers, John Cone. John will be performing with the Downhill Strugglers Friday, September 7th, doing an afternoon storytelling workshop, Saturday, September 8th at 2 p.m. in the Old Tone Roots Music Festival at Cool Whisper Farm in North Hillsdale, New York. For more, oldtonemusicfestival.com. So, John, the incredible influence that you and the Ramblers have had on so many of us, will it live on?
That's what's so interesting to me right now. I mentioned Jalopy Theater in New York earlier. That's a new push, a new focus, a new flowering of this music. And this Old Tone Festival this year is reflecting some of that. Some of the musicians who are playing now at the festival, they're really wonderful, and they're young, and they're revitalizing it. You know, for a while, I thought maybe we were cranky old guys and good, and we had a lot of fun. But now there's Bill and the Bells. One of the groups playing, they're from Bristol, Virginia, and it's a wonderful guy who sings like 1920s records, and these two young women who are just fantastic singing. It sounds like an old record without the scratch.
without the scratch.
And Hubby Jenkins, the black guy from New York, but he's around Jalopy now. He plays Rihanna Giddens, and she's very famous now.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home no more to roam. I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going over home.
And then Anna and Elizabeth, two young women, one of whom is just a great an Appalachian-style ballad singer as you want.
Been a long time traveling here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body down. Been a long time traveling here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body a long time traveling here below. Been a long time traveling away from my home. Been a long time traveling here below. To lay this body down.
But they also are pushing the envelope. They're pushing it and making new sounds and reconsidering all kinds of things. It's just so exciting. And the Downhill Strugglers are just, you know, taking the same position that the Ramblers took. But the young guys, I tell you, it's a wonderful thing that's going on now.
You live in the Hudson Valley, John Cone. And, of course, WAMC gets to the Hudson Valley in many, many different stations. Is there anything unique you can tell us about your experience in the Hudson Valley?
Well, I live here. I live in Putnam County. So while the Ramblers were touring across the United States and sometimes around the world, we were also developing a home music scene. I had a band for a while. We called ourselves the Putnam String County Band.
Yeah.
And our fiddler was Jay Unger.
Who we know so well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he grew out of this. And then he started, you know, the whole Ashokan thing and his wonderful music there. So that came from the local home fires, keep them going. Just in a strange way, it's parallel. It's not the same as Pete, you know, moving around from the union movements and the civil rights to focusing on the Clearwater and the Hudson Valley issues. So I don't know exactly how to take this further, but I know that, well, the fact that you're having a festival upstate New York of this music, which has mostly been in lower New York, is very, very exciting. Oh, and on the festival is a young woman named Nora Brown. Old, and she's as good as any of us, and better. And she just is so interested in the music, and it's exciting to see the music bubbling up from below. And of course, there's festivals all across the South and in the West Coast. But your question is about what's going on in the Hudson Valley. Is that what your question is?
No, I was more interested in just how you feel about being in the Hudson Valley and what it means to you. That's all.
Well, it means I can get to New York City if I want to go to a museum, but I can't park, so it's hard.
You have to take the train.
It means that I live out in a beautiful part of the country, and I have a barn and a studio and a creek and a garden and friends and neighbors. And we've even bought a beautiful Methodist church and made it into a cultural center where we put on concerts. And somehow we've avoided the more popular side of it. We never play it at the Hudson River Revival. That's a different, more powerful view of what the folk and pop music world is. Unable to exist and quite busy.
John Cohn, we have to get you to Arlo's Church, which is 5 minutes or 10 minutes from my house. We have to get you to play there. You'll sell the place out and it'll be standing room only, and it would be great to have you and the Strugglers there.
Yeah, love to do it.
We are so pleased that you've spent this time with us. And we've been talking with musicologist, photographer, filmmaker, and founding member of the New Lost City Ramblers, John Cohn. He'll be performing with the Downhill Strugglers Friday, September 7th, and doing an afternoon storytelling workshop on Saturday, September 8th at 2 p.m. in the Old Tone Roots Music Festival at Cool Whisper Farm in North Hillsdale, New York. For more information, head to www.oldtonemusicfestival.com. John Cohn, I cannot tell you what a pleasure this has been. Unbelievable. I am so grateful that you've spent this time with us.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I'd look forward to meeting you in person sometime.
I sure hope we can. I'd love that. And I'll wear my John Cohn jacket if I can find it.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. They had a quarrel one day. Johnny said he would leave her. He said he's going away to Rome. Never coming home. Frankie, she begged and she pleaded. My love, Johnny, please stay. Now, oh my honey, I've done you wrong, but please don't go away. And Johnny cried, and Frank sighed. Oh, I'm going away, I'm gonna leave me today, I'm never coming home. Gonna miss me, honey, in the days to come, when the winter wind begins to blow the kind of summer, and you think of the way you're gonna wish me back. Now, man, your hour's come. On underneath her silk kimono,
you've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.